We're joined now by James Herbert on Twitter at Outside the NBA. Does a phenomenal job covering the league for CBS Sports. Hey, James, how you doing? Thanks for joining me.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to ask you in a moment about your oral history on Dirk Nowitzki. I love that piece, and I'm really bummed that Dirk walked without us giving, I feel like nationally, we didn't necessarily give him his just due. But how about that day yesterday? You go through, and I mean, San Antonio wins. I don't think people fully expect the Spurs to win that series, but certainly that was a little bit of a surprise. What surprised you the most yesterday? Was it Philly dropping that game? And also, what's more sustainable? Like, can the Magic actually knock off the Raptors? Do you actually expect the Nets to win the Sixers? Or what kind of an upset maybe are we looking at here in round one?
I think the least sustainable and the one that surprised me the most was the Magic win over Toronto. I look at those two teams. I did not expect Orlando to be able to score like that against the Raptors. And if you go back and you look at some of the shots that DJ Augustine made, I mean, the Magic had like a charmed night. They made some crazy difficult shots. I would also say they had like insane poise to go into that building. I know there's no pressure on them. No one expects them to win, but
right. That's
a crazy atmosphere. Like, I'm from Toronto. I know what that building is like in the playoffs. And they just walked in there with a guard right from them and put a toucher on the Raptors. And right at the end, they had more clutch shots than Toronto did. And they're a few guys on that roster now that have deep bearing. The Magic have very little of that, and Orlando won anyway. So I would be surprised if Toronto missed the sort of amount of open shots that they did in game one going forward, but you obviously have to credit the Magic for making them uncomfortable and putting them in that high-pressure situation where the whole crowd in Toronto, the crazy crowd that was going nuts at the beginning, all seemed really nervous at the end of that game with their history of losing game ones. I would say the one that seems maybe the most sustainable is Brooklyn and how they beat the Sixers. That was a really tough matchup for Philadelphia during the regular season just because they struggled defending quick guards, scoring-minded guards all season long, and the Nets come at you with Russell, Dinwiddie, and LeVert and just put a ton of pressure on your pick-and-roll defense and just on your, honestly, just like one-on-one defense off the dribble. Like that is what they do to teams. They spread you out, and then they have guys that can get buckets, and Philadelphia all season long had trouble with that. And then when the reason why I say that might be the most sustainable, like I do think Philadelphia is the better team, but if they either don't have Joel Embiid or they have this sort of wonky, somewhat healthy version of Joel Embiid, then I think there is a window there. There's a huge opportunity for Brooklyn to take advantage of that, because that's the one massive advantage that Philly has, is that the size and physicality of Embiid was something that really, like, Brooklyn's roster isn't set up to be able to compete with. And the whole idea was feed it to him early, get the Nets in foul trouble and draw double teams and find open shooters. And he didn't play a ton of minutes. And when he was out there, he didn't seem particularly confident. Like, he trusted his body. He was missing wide open jumpers and settling for those even after he missed them. So if I was a Sixers fan, my number one concern would be Joel Embiid's health. And then right after that, it's just containing those guards that the Nets have that have been roasting Philadelphia in all of their matchups this season.
Yeah, Philadelphia is so, so interesting. Like, the idea of Jimmy Butler, he was, what, a plus 11 yesterday? I mean, he was their team yesterday. Embiid and Simmons had brutal, brutal games. Of course, we don't know fully if Joel Embiid is healthy. But the idea of Jimmy Butler being with a couple kids who can't come through in big spots again in Philadelphia, and sort of the Sixers pinning a lot of their hopes on the idea that he's going to re-sign. I mean, it could be 2 or 3 months from now, and we're going, well, Philadelphia's kind of back to square one here. Yes, they have two really good young players, but we still have questions about whether or not Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are good players for each other, like whether or not they complement each other. Do you get the feeling that the Sixers are going to look back and rue the day they traded for Jimmy Butler?
I think it's too early to say that, but that's sort of the problem. It's too early to come up with these sort of sweeping conclusions about this roster in general.
Sure.
And it's playoff time. Like, there's no more time for experimentation. Like, they have to be a cohesive team. And I think the hope was that, yeah, this first round series might be a little bit bumpy, but they're more talented than the Nets, and they can use this series as sort of a tune-up for when it gets really difficult in the second round. And by the end of it, they might have a better sense of their identity and what their game plan needs to be on a night-to-night basis. And then that can sort of fuel them going forward. Well, after getting punched in the face in game one, I don't know that you can really look at the series the same way anymore. I'm not saying I expect Philadelphia to just be in trouble this whole time or lose the series. Like, it's possible, but I think when you're talking about Jimmy, what you're really talking about is an overall lack of cohesion that stems from the fact that this group really has not played a ton of games together. I mean, they've really had three different teams throughout the regular season, with first the Jimmy Butler trade, second the Tobias Harris trade, and then after the Harris trade, they really struggled to get all five of their starters on the court for extended stretches at the same time. I mean, Embiid missed a lot of time after the All-Star break. He missed some more time right near the end of the regular season. He's clearly not right. And I just think that the Nets came in with, like, such a clear identity and clear game plan. And the Sixers, while more talented, didn't have that same sort of sense of purpose out there. And in the playoffs, you kind of need to have that, and they're going to need to figure that out quickly. They're going to need to problem solve and make some adjustments.
Oh, James. We have lost James. James, are you there? Maybe we'll call James back. James Herbert with me, outside the NBA. Does a phenomenal job covering the league for CBS Sports. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the Sixers thing is very, very intriguing to me. And I would think, you know, I would expect from some of the upsets that we saw yesterday, I don't think the Magic are going to be able to beat the Raptors. I don't think the Nets are going to be able to beat the Sixers. I mean, if there's anything that gets a team like the Sixers, who clearly has more talent, on the right track, it's a slap in the face in game one. And, you know, the Magic were able to hit a big shot late in order to steal a win from the Raptors. The Nets controlled that game. So I would certainly be more concerned with Brooklyn long term, with Philadelphia blowing that and potentially a first round exit long term. I think probably the Raptors Magic series kind of corrects itself. Let's go back to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline. James Herbert with us at Outside the NBA on Twitter, covers the league for CBS Sports. James, we got you back.
Yes. Sorry
yes.
About that.
No. No problem. No problem. Communication issues sometimes occur. Let me ask you this. Let's spin it forward to today. We got basketball coming up here in 10 minutes. Boston hosting Indiana. The Blazers and Thunder at 3:30 should be a fascinating series. Detroit and Milwaukee. People expect that one to be a pretty quick out. And then Houston, Utah should be a good one tonight as well. When you look at these games today, which one intrigues you the most? Which series do you have your eye on? And Boston, Indiana, I just want your thoughts on the Celtics. I think they've had such a weird season, but I still, when I look at the Eastern Conference, I go, you know, top to bottom, I'll take that roster over everybody else's, and yeah, I'll take the experience there. I still think Boston gets it right here.
Yeah, I think I'll start there. Honestly, like, to answer your question, they all intrigue me a lot, except for the Bucks Piston series, which I expect to be a walkover.
Yep.
But with certain Boston, I mean, I wrote a story about the Celtics a few weeks ago where I basically came to terms with the fact that I don't know who this team is, and that I have too much time thinking about them, and we're just not going to really know until the playoffs, because they have all this talent. They seem theoretically really equipped for the grind of the playoffs, with their depth, with their versatility, with their ability to kind of play big, play small, play multiple styles. That's when you sort of need multiple playmakers on the court, is to make yourself more unpredictable. And all these sort of internal squabbles about shots, about usage, about getting players comfortable, like those things don't matter as much, I think, in the playoffs, where it's just about figuring out ways to score and ways to win. But the one thing that I sort of noted in that story from a Brad Stevens quote from a game that I went to was, he talked about how all season they just haven't valued position. They just haven't treated every possession like it was important. There's stretches where their defensive intensity is not there. There's stretches where offensively they're just not really playing as a team. They don't really have any sense of cohesion. And that's been a thing that's been part of their identity all season. And if you think of Celtics teams of the past and the Brad Stevens era, they've really valued the ball. They've been extremely
right.
tough. They played extremely hard. And I think that's exactly the kind of team that the Indiana Pacers are. Like, that sort of defines the Indiana Pacers. Every possession they treat like it's sort of like a scrum. Like, they're so physical. You know, pretty brand of basketball. I mean, I'm partial to, like, Domantas Sabonis is, like, screening and passing, all that. I think that there are some things to appreciate aesthetically about them, but I don't think people get super excited to watch Indiana, like, beautiful ball chucking threes all the time. They don't play particularly fast.
Right.
But what they do is they execute. They play with a purpose. They get shots. A lot of these are two-point shots, which are not in vogue in today's NBA, but they're able to get guys shots in the areas where they're comfortable, and they absolutely know their identity, and you never hear a peep about chemistry issues, never hear a peep about anyone wanting more shots. So it's just a really interesting contrast in this series. I think, as you said, Boston is a more talented team, but over the course of the season, I think Indiana has been such a less volatile team and a much more resilient team, and you need that resilience in the playoffs. So the last year, Celtics, they had that. They had so much resilience. They kept going farther than anybody thought that they could. This year, Celtics have just been an entirely different story. They've been extremely affected by the expectations around them, and I think by individual goals and people wanting to kind of take the next step as a player.
Yeah, it feels like partially sometimes they got bored throughout the season. But it feels like at some point it's just, you know, guys, this is when it matters. So now let's all just assume whatever role it is we have carved out over the course of the last season. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about the past. Go out and beat the crap out of the Indiana Pacers. I would expect it to happen in five or six games, but you're right. I mean, the Pacers are kind of the antithesis of all the drama that we've seen in Boston. Speaking of drama in historic NBA franchises, it was quite the week for the Los Angeles Lakers. Magic Johnson, back to what he does best, tweeting terrible tweets. He said yesterday, "I've had a great Saturday watching the NBA playoff games!" The Nets shocked the Sixers, and the Magic did the same to the Raptors. Golden State played like champs today. And, like, that's why I needed Magic back on Twitter, because I had no idea that all those things occurred yesterday without him. James, the Lakers as a whole, obviously here in Cleveland, we've got a close eye on everything that's developed out there. It's funny because I play contrarian with that team, with LeBron all the time, and I do it in my head to myself. I'm going, it can't be as much of a mess as everybody is saying that it is right now. And then I go, well, if Rob Pelinka is still heading up the operation, then maybe it is. How do they fix it? Is it possible a couple months from now we're going, you know, wow, they fixed things really quickly and people are back on board with LeBron in Los Angeles? Where are you at with the Lakers?
I think they need a full-on cultural overhaul. Like, it's not just in terms of personnel. I think it's like an attitude shift. I just think there's been so much sort of hubris within that organization for so long. There's this attitude of, like, we're the Lakers, so we're going to get everybody we want, and we're going to win all the games that we want, and championships will come to us, and star players will come to us. And I think they need a dose of humility. They need to accept that this season was an abject failure. Stop talking about how, oh, if they had only been healthier, oh, if this and that. Like, I mean, LeBron James came back, and they had time to turn their season around and at least make the playoffs. And if that had happened, then you never know. I mean, you know as well as anyone in Cleveland that once LeBron gets there, it doesn't matter all that much where the team is seated. But I think the front office, the organization, top to bottom, needs to acknowledge that something is badly broken and needs to be fixed. And they need to acknowledge that the front office did a poor job in surrounding LeBron with players that actually fit his style. And I think the next coach of the team, the next lead executive of the team, if there is even going to be another executive in that front office, they really need to be all on the same page, and everybody needs to kind of know where they stand and know where this organization wants to go and what style of basketball they want to play. Because I think it's sort of like the first step is accepting that this has been a total failure and that it hasn't gone the way that they thought. And they need to approach this like they're any other organization, not just that it's the Lakers. Everything is going to work out just fine because they're the Lakers.
James, last thing on Dirk, my oral history of Dirk Nowitzki, an absolute legend. I really enjoyed it. How much fun was it putting it together?
Oh, so much fun. I mean, some of those interviews, like I did one interview with this guy, Mike Procopio, is a player development coach for the Mavericks, who, like, his whole life day-to-day is just sort of trolling Dirk Nowitzki and them joking with each other and him hurling insults at Dirk and Dirk hurling insults back at him. And we talked about that. We talked about their, like, games of quiz up that they play all night where they're doing Dallas Mavericks history and Dirk Nowitzki represents, like, half the answers to the questions. And, like, just things like that are fun to report. And, like, obviously, yeah, like, to talk to players and teammates about his work ethic and how much they appreciated being around him. Like, I sort of talked to players all season about this and put it together right at the end. People, whether they played with him 20 years ago or whether they played with him this season, like, from Nick Van Exel to, like, Ryan Brokoff, a rookie from Australia who grew up idolizing Dirk and is now gets to be on the same team. Like, guys just loved talking about Dirk. So that's what made it really fun to do. He's a superstar. He's an absolute legend and icon in Dallas. But I think the thing that makes him really special is that he doesn't act that way. Like, if you talk to anybody about what it's being, what it's like being around him day to day. Like they're sort of in awe of how sort of grounded he's remained and how much of a goofball he is and how he still puts in the work. Like he really wants to be the best, even when, you know, he's 40 years old and he knows he can't be the best anymore. Like he's just kind of that kind of dude. And people like talking about the kind of person that he is in addition to the kind of player that obviously we all know he has been for the last 20 years.
No, and James, I'm glad you brought that up because that's what comes through in the piece. And it's especially refreshing in the NBA where egos can be, you know, considered a little bit too big maybe for certain guys. And this is a guy who probably should have a massive ego and doesn't. And it was a very enjoyable piece. James, I really appreciate the time, man. You do a phenomenal job. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.